KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Since democracy was invented, philosophers have argued that it contains the seeds of its own destruction.
As President Trump moves to seize power, we talk to one expert about what is and isn't on par with previous authoritarian slides.
Today is Wednesday, February 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In one of those moves, the Trump administration has halted the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
We'll talk to a longtime observer of the agency.
Very frightening to think that an agency that was created by Congress could just suddenly disappear.
We'll also hear about an international crime ring allegedly behind the string of break-ins at professional athletes' homes.
And a look at the images coming out of the administration's immigration crackdown.
You put anybody in shackles, you're going to make them look like a criminal, and that becomes how people contextualize their tattoos.
That's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A Trump administration executive order aims to expand the president's sway further over what are known as independent regulatory agencies. The order is part of a string of actions aimed at expanding presidential power. More from NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben.
Independent agencies include well-known entities like the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They were set up by Congress with some insulation from presidential power. This order, signed Tuesday afternoon, would remove much of that insulation, requiring those agencies to run new regulations by the White House. In addition, the Trump administration would have power over their spending. This comes after Trump has fired top officials from some of these agencies, such as the National Labor Relations Board. Those firings have led to lawsuits, and this order could similarly spur more legal action. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
A crowd gathered in front of the headquarters for the Department of Health and Human Services today in Washington. They were protesting cuts to scientific research by the Trump administration. More from NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin.
People braved snow and freezing temperatures to protest the firing of government researchers and cuts to academic research currently paused by the courts. Signs read, "No one voted for polio," and "I'd rather be in my lab working on cures for cancer." One of the speakers was Connor Phillips, who told the crowd he has cerebral palsy.
My experience inspired me to become a scientist at the NIH, where I have developed new therapies to improve the lives of other children with cerebral palsy.
He says after cuts at the National Institutes of Health, he can't continue his research even though he was a postgraduate volunteer. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul is responding to an announcement by the Trump administration that's doing away with the congestion pricing plan recently put in place in New York City. The plan instituted tolls for vehicles entering the city below 60th Street. Hochul defended the policy and accused Trump of going after New York City as part of his, quote, revenge tour.
We are a nation of states. This is what we fought for. This is what people like Alexander Hamilton and others fought for. To set up a system, we are not subservient to a king or anyone else out of Washington.
Trump, in a statement on his social media platform, said, quote, congestion pricing is dead. Manhattan and all of New York is saved. Long live the king. The pricing plan was designed to reduce traffic and generate millions for mass transit in New York. Fed members at their meeting last month opted not to raise short-term interest rates, citing concerns about the prospect of inflation. Now it appears those concerns may have been justified. Fed policy members citing Trump administration tariffs and deportation of migrants, along with strong spending by consumers as pushing up prices. Trump, meanwhile, is trying to distance himself from a rise in inflation, saying it had nothing to do with his return to the Oval Office. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street. The Dow was up 71 points today. This is NPR. After comments from President Trump yesterday in which he appeared to blame Russia's war against Ukraine on Ukraine and its President Volodymyr Zelensky, relations appear to be souring further between Trump and the Ukrainian leader. Trump's comments came after Russia and the U.S. held a meeting during which they promised to work toward bringing the nearly three-year-old war to a close without including Ukraine in the discussion. Zelensky today accused Trump of living in what he termed a Russian-made disinformation space. This June, the Tony Awards, Broadway's highest honors, will have a new host, Cynthia Erivo. The British actress has been a constant presence throughout the Hollywood awards season. She's up for an Oscar as Elphaba, the Green Witch in Wicked. But as Jeff London reports, the stage is in her blood.
After playing many theater roles in London, Cynthia Erivo burst on the Broadway scene in 2015 as Celie in the Tony Award-winning revival of The Color Purple. Gonna hold my head up, gonna put She won a Tony for Best Actress in a Musical that season. And on June 8th this year, she'll serve as host for the 78th annual Tony Awards. It's been quite a year for Erivo. She's been nominated for several awards for Wicked, and it was just announced that she'll be appearing as the title character in Jesus Christ Superstar at the Hollywood Bowl in August. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Crude oil futures prices gained ground today. Oil up 40 cents a barrel to settle at $72.25 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Is the United States headed toward autocracy? That is a question prompted by a steady stream of executive orders seeking to consolidate power in the White House and upend long-held policies and norms. New York Times opinion writer M. Gessen lived through much of Russia's slide into autocracy and wrote a book about it. They argue that one of the ways that Vladimir Putin consolidated power was by making a series of arguments that seemed outrageous at the time, like the idea that the LGBT population was a threat to Russian sovereignty.
You know, I thought it was silly. I completely failed to take it seriously. And I certainly didn't realize that it was a personal threat and that within a couple of years I'd have to flee the country.
M. Gessen joins me now.
Good to be here.
So I want to start with a recent column you wrote, and you argued that the, quote, barrage of unthinkable ideas that Trump has put out there in the last month may seem chaotic, may not seem to be connected, but in your mind, they are. Walk us through that.
Well, I think bad ideas as such actually do a lot of the work of building autocracy. And, you know, we imagine autocracy as extreme repression, as the usurpation of power, and all of that is true. And for some people, living under autocracy is terrifying because they're direct political targets. But for most people, from my experience, or most of the time, living under autocracy is just dumb. We are engaged now with things like, should the United States buy Greenland? Did DI cause the plane and helicopter collision? These are absurd propositions, and yet intelligent people start asking stupid questions like, can the United States take over Gaza and redevelop it as a seaside resort? The idea that people have obligations to one another, that there is a law-based world order, at least we aspire to having one, all of this is being delegitimized with these bad ideas.
Mm-hmm. I want to do the radio host thing here of pushing back on the idea I've invited you onto this program to talk about, but I'm very curious about how you think about this, because Americans voted to return Trump to power, and there's a lot of anecdotal and broader evidence that a lot of voters hear conversations like the one that we're having right now as white noise. This is alarmist worries from elites at magazines and national news outlets, and they either don't believe these warnings or they don't care. How have you thought about this since the election, and what do you think about that dynamic that seems to really be playing out?
You know, a couple of things. One is that I think that Americans voted for Donald Trump because there's some really major problems with the system of government as it's constituted. And I think that basically the Democratic Party, for at least three election cycles, has now insisted that things are fine just the way they are. that we just have to live in some sort of imaginary normal, really refusing to hear that the normal, whatever that is, isn't working for a lot of people, that they are anxious and miserable, and they would rather throw a grenade at the way things are in the form of Donald Trump than continue living the way they've been living. And the reason it's important to think about that now is that it's still the same sort of dynamic, where Trump is taking a sledgehammer to the world as we've known it, and the Democrats are saying, well, you can't do that. That's not how the rules are written. Americans have said that the way that the rules are written and the way that the system functions doesn't work for them. So there has to be a bigger idea. The rules were written for a reason. They were there to perform certain functions. They were there to make sure that our obligations to one another are, in fact, fulfilled. And they haven't been.
I think a theme across all of the close analysis of what has happened to countries that have slid into authoritarianism in the past is that a lot of the times the power is willingly given over. And when you look across the country right now, whether it's large corporate-owned media settling lawsuits or big corporations suddenly changing their policies and their political actions, or nonprofits stripping words from their websites right now, what do you think is so different from the first time Trump is office to right now, that statements he made the first time around kind of went in and out of a lot of these actors' ears, and this time they are stopping what they are doing, they are recalculating, they are making changes to be on the right side of Donald Trump policies?
You know, I think that these decisions are rational, each one of them taken separately, and they are rational even if you contrast them to Trump's first term. The threat wasn't as real. I think that whoever makes these decisions at businesses or at nonprofits or at universities 8 years ago thought quite reasonably that Trump was an anomalous political event in this country's history. With Trump's second election, we can no longer claim that. This is what this country is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that rationally, people are settling in for the long haul and making decisions about their organizations that will benefit them, or at least keep them safer in the short term. And that's really the problem with this kind of abeyance, is that it is reasonable, it is well thought through, and it is sometimes even values-based. People are thinking, I'm protecting my employees, I'm protecting my organization. The problem is that when everyone does that, that is exactly how autocracy is built. It cannot be built without people's cooperation.
M. Gessen is an opinion columnist at the New York Times and the author of The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
The Trump administration's freeze of U.S. foreign aid could not have come at a more precarious time for the Middle East. The U.S. Agency for International Development had been one of the biggest funders of aid projects for Palestinians to encourage stability, to encourage peace. Now, projects in the Middle East are under a stop work order and face an uncertain future. NPR's Daniel Estrin explains what this looks like in the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
We walk down a wet and muddy road in the Palestinian city of Halhul. It's a mountain town in the West Bank's southern area.
The road is dug up, and underneath we see a tiny water pipe. What are you guys doing here?
The town's water maintenance man, Isam Abu Rameshan, says they're fixing a burst water pipe. It happens every couple of days. USAID had been trying to fix that. Now, the world's biggest humanitarian aid organization is effectively shut down. The Trump administration says foreign aid is not aligned with American interests, and it's reevaluating the aid worldwide. Palestinian engineer Mohammed Spitan says he was working with USAID on a $46 million project, smart technology to find leaks and fix the water system. It's a parched area. The old pipes struggle to deliver water high up in the hills. Sometimes residents go months without running water. He says USAID wasn't just paying to fix it. He says USAID provided American contractors with top expertise in infrastructure construction. They can't be replaced easily. Wherever you drive in Palestinian cities, you see billboards marking USAID road and water projects from over the years. It's been a decades-long U.S. mission to build the capacity for the Palestinians to have their own independent state. So here's a sign. It's written on marble, USAID, installation of water pipes, funded by the American people.
2012.
We met the mayor of the town, Jihad Abu Asabeh. He says these USAID projects employed a lot of Palestinians. Cutting funding will mean jobs lost in an economy that has suffered since the deadly Hamas attack on Israel in 2023 led to restrictions on Palestinians in the West Bank. The mayor says this will drive instability and worsen the already dire economic situation that the Palestinian people have been facing since October 7th, 2023. A Palestinian official who requested anonymity because they're not authorized to speak publicly tells NPR the U.S. has also frozen aid to the Palestinian security forces, which have worked with Israel to patrol the West Bank. USAID has also helped fund humanitarian aid in Gaza amid war. The State Department says it will continue life-saving aid for Gaza. In President Trump's first term, Congress passed a law allocating $250 million over 5 years for projects bringing Palestinians and Israelis together. Those funds are also frozen now for projects like the Jerusalem Youth Chorus for Palestinians and Israelis. Project Rosanna brought Palestinian nurses to Israeli hospitals to learn new skills. Ken Bob from Project Rosanna says that's on hold now.
We were just about to launch a training program in February for representatives from all the Palestinian hospitals to deal with diabetes. And everyone was very excited about coming and really training in Israel for a couple days. And of course, we had to cancel it.
He says it comes at the worst time, after a devastating war, when trust between Israelis and Palestinians is at rock bottom.
People in the healthcare profession are traditionally very well respected in their communities. And so have them be voices of common sense and understanding really can help build this sense of trust between Israelis and Palestinians that is so deficient right now.
Driving around the West Bank, Palestinian water engineer Mohammed Spitan took us up steep hills to see the water infrastructure the U.S. has helped build over the years. But he keeps making quick U-turns. Producer Nuha Musleh asks, is the Israeli military here?
Behind us there is a settlement and the military post.
He didn't want to risk driving too close to Israeli settlements and military outposts, a reminder of one of the only exceptions to the Trump administration's foreign aid freeze around the world. The State Department says U.S. military financing for Israel continues. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Al-Hul in the West Bank.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. By now, you have probably heard about the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Consumer Watchdog was established in 2011 in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The initial goal was to better regulate banks and other institutions that provide financial services. But in recent weeks, as President Trump has taken charge, about 150 employees have been fired, and the rest have been told to stop working. Susan Tompor is a personal finance columnist for the Detroit Free Press. She has spent years writing about the CFPB and the role it plays in helping consumers, and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Scott.
What was your first response to these moves, the firings and then the stop work order?
Well, I think the first concern is, of course, President Trump had a first administration and the CFPB was a much diluted organization or agency, wasn't as active, but it still existed. So it was a little disturbing, I think, to think that you turn on the consumerfinance.gov and see a 404 error sign. It's a little bit disturbing. I did since find out, though, you can still file complaints if you go through some of those pages. And today, just to test it out, I actually called their hotline, and a person did answer. So I don't I don't know if how that is, but what she told me was that she could still take complaints, but they have stopped action.
And you've framed in writing, you've called the CFPB at times a consumer cop on the beat. Right. This is an organization that could address violations, shoddy practices, fraud, hidden fees. That's how you wrote about it. And yet there has been constant criticism. A lot of Republicans in Congress, a lot of business groups have had a big problem with the CFPB. What's the best way to frame the objections that have come in over the years?
Well, they didn't want it to start with. They said the other the Republicans and the bankers said we didn't need this to start. So go back, 15 years. They did not want this agency. They said other agencies could handle these things. So nothing's changed since then. But the CFPB has expanded its reach. Bankers are saying they're involved into overreach or overextension of their powers. And I think that's the argument right now. A big case that the CFPB was involved with was trying to get lower fees on credit cards and checking accounts, overdrafts, late fees. They were trying to lower the fees on these late fees for credit cards and checking accounts. You can imagine the banks don't want to do that. Nobody, no business, wants to have government come in and tell them what their fees should be. But consumers, on the other hand, if you don't have this agency, you're stuck going to all sorts of different agencies. You might go to the Attorney General's office in your state. You might go to the Better Business Bureau. You might go to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. This is kind of a one-stop shop. And what's good about a one-stop shop is they can spot trends. They can spot when they're seeing a lot of reports from against one company doing XYZ. And if they're going against the law, I think it could be easier to find and to bring action against that company. That would be my argument. That would be why I think this does have value.
Look, a lot of people will come across the CFPB, or in the past at least, during important life purchases or moments where they feel like they're really in a rut, buying a house, buying a car, suddenly being out of a lot of money. You've been writing about these topics for a long time. What advice would you give to Americans kind of navigating these tricky purchases if they can no longer turn to a place like the CFPB?
Well, I think it's going to become increasingly important to do more research, talk to people who have had success with certain companies, don't deal with companies that are not responding to their consumers. That's kind of hard to do, but it is going to be on the consumer to do even more research. You don't want to be in a situation where you didn't read the fine print. You might want to have somebody else read your fine print on some of these cases. Too often, we trust people, unfortunately, and sometimes that trust isn't well placed.
And in a case like this, you know, nobody's going to be watching, or maybe someone will watch. I don't know who might watch, but you're not going to have this big agency watching any longer if this change continues.
That's Susan Tompore, personal finance columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Okay, among the many federal agencies experiencing staffing cuts under the Trump administration, the U.S. Forest Service. It's responsible for everything from maintaining hiking trails to helping fight wildfires and making public lands less prone to fire. Some of those workers are now warning that staffing cuts make the agency less prepared for the upcoming fire season. Oregon Public Broadcasting's April Ehrlich reports.
As a Forest Service ecologist in Oregon, Lanny Flaherty's day-to-day job involved collecting data, a lot of it related to plants. Some of Flaherty's data goes into wildfire behavior modeling. For example, understanding where brush and trees grow on a landscape gives firefighters a better understanding of how a fire might move through it.
When you bring in 5,000 firefighters from all over the country, you need local specialization there to tell them where the stuff is.
Flaherty was one of 2,000 probationary workers in the Forest Service who were recently fired. That number was confirmed by a spokesperson with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service. In interviews, almost a dozen current and former Forest Service employees say they're worried about the way these cuts will affect fire season. Flaherty says it's not just his data collection that's affected. He also helps fight fires when the Forest Service is understaffed.
Every role is so dynamic. There's a huge amount of those secondary roles that aren't just directly digging line or swinging a tool that support the firefighting operations.
Field rangers tasked with patrolling the vast wildlands that make up the West were also among the people fired, including Liz Crandall. She's based in Central Oregon.
I'm eyes on the woods. I'm the person that's seeing every corner of the woods that others might not see.
Destroying abandoned campfires before they turned dangerous was part of Crandall's job. And like Flaherty, she assisted firefighters when needed. Crandall says she has responded to a dozen major wildfires.
I'm a firefighter type 2. I went to guard school. I have my chainsaw certification. I'm able to go on a fire line.
Crandall and Flaherty both worked for the Forest Service for years, but they entered into probationary periods when they took on new roles. In a statement, a spokesperson with the USDA said the agency did not fire any operational firefighters and is, quote, committed to preserving essential safety positions. They did not respond to questions about employees who were certified to fight fires as secondary roles or people who helped do fire prevention work.
You can come up with a lot of ways in which this goes sideways very quickly for mountain communities, for forest communities.
Aaron Weiss is with the conservation advocacy group Center for Western Priorities. He says he's concerned that these firings will hinder wildfire prevention work like prescribed burning.
This is the single best tactic that we have across the West to minimizing wildfire risk when it comes to wildfire season.
And this is all happening on top of a hiring freeze on seasonal workers at the Forest Service that the Biden administration announced last year. For NPR News, I'm April Ehrlich in Portland.
This is NPR News.
People are preparing to rebuild after the Los Angeles wildfires.
Well, it's getting better every day. You know, the worst part of the shock is over. Now it's looking at the cleanup.
But should neighborhoods at high risk be rebuilt at all? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Have you ever watched a rom-com and noticed how often architects turn up as love interests?
We're thinking that the foundation was most likely laid like way back 1969 with Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch.
Hollywood's lust for architects. We'll investigate after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Some former workers with the U.S. Forest Service worry about the Trump administration's cuts to that agency and what reduced staffing means for the fire season ahead. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Ehrlich reports.
Field rangers and ecologists were among the 2,000 Forest Service workers the U.S. Department of Agriculture says were fired. Many were also certified wildland firefighters that assist on major fires, including former park ranger Liz Crandall. Crandall, who's based in Central Oregon, says she has helped fight 12 large wildfires.
I'm a firefighter type 2. I have my chainsaw certification. I'm able to go on a fire line.
A USDA spokesperson says the Forest Service did not fire any operational firefighters and is, quote, committed to preserving essential safety positions, but did not respond to questions about employees who were certified to fight fires as secondary roles. For NPR News, I'm April Ehrlich in Portland, Oregon.
A delegation of Syrian Jews from the U.S. is in Damascus on a historic visit, the first by religious leaders since the Jewish community left Syria in the early 1990s. There are now fewer than 10 Syrian Jews living in Damascus. As NPR's Jane Araf tells us, the visit is aimed at rebuilding the community.
We're in a site that's hugely important to Syrian Jews. It's the Jewish cemetery, as it's called, in Damascus. While part of it is nice, neat rows, a lot of the rest of it is destroyed, broken gravestones from when a highway was built through here decades ago. This delegation that has come here has come to call for the U.S. lifting of sanctions on Syria and to ask the Syrian government, the new government, to allow Syrian Jews to return and eventually reclaim property. Most of what they want to do is restore the Syrian Jewish community in a place where the community thrived for centuries.
This is NPR. There are growing signs that the Trump administration and Elon Musk could be preparing to cancel a NASA program to return astronauts to the moon for the first time in more than five decades. NPR's Scott Newman has more.
The Artemis Moon program was launched by President Trump in 2017 as a step toward a mission to Mars. And even though SpaceX has a contract to build the lunar lander, many now think that Musk's government efficiency team has the program's moon rocket, known as the SLS, in its sights. Todd Harrison, a space policy expert with the American Enterprise Institute, says if the SLS is canceled,
it means the Artemis program, as envisioned by the first Trump administration, is effectively dead.
Earlier this month, Boeing, the main contractor for the SLS, warned employees on the project to prepare for layoffs. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
In Arizona, authorities say a mid-air collision involving two small planes has left two people dead. Federal safety investigators are looking into the cause of the crash today near an airport just outside of Tucson. The FAA says two people were aboard each plane involved in the mid-air collision. This comes after a pilot died on a private jet last week that veered off a runway in Arizona. Stocks finished slightly higher on Wall Street. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station.
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Amid its constant stream of executive orders, the Trump administration signed one on Tuesday that expands his power over independent agencies. Independent agencies, well, like the name suggests, those agencies have long had some freedom from a president's whims. Trump wants to change that. This is part of a string of actions aimed at expanding presidential power. NPR White House correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben is here to explain. Danielle, hi.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey. Okay. So explain and I guess start with just because it might not be immediately clear why this is important. Why is it?
Right. Well, let me start with some super basics. In the executive branch, there are two broad types of agencies. There are executive agencies, and that includes departments everyone knows, the Department of Defense, Department of Justice. Uh-huh. And then there are these independent agencies. Those have been set up by Congress with some insulation from presidential power. Now, these are often agencies that have some sort of specialized knowledge for creating regulations. Think of the SEC really understanding the stock market, for example. But also, there's often, at these agencies, a board or commission leading them, and the members have staggered terms. And a result of that is there's stability across presidential administrations for what rules they make, for example. So those agencies include things like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which puts out those recalls on unsafe products. There's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, which insures bank deposits. Now, one big way these agencies are independent is that the Supreme Court has said the president can't fire their heads for political reasons. And also, these agencies haven't had to run their rulemaking by the White House. But that is where this order comes in.
Aha. Okay. So what does this order do?
Well, it says these agencies now do have to run new regulations by the White House. And in addition, it says these agencies now need to have White House liaisons and also check in to make sure that what they're doing aligns with White House policy. And central to all of this is the Office of Management and Budget, whose director is Russell Vogt. He has been a big proponent of giving the president this kind of power. And relatedly, Project 2025, a conservative blueprint for remaking the government, also advocates for presidents claiming this power.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around what this actually is. Like, give me an example of what this could look like in practice.
Sure. So here's one hypothetical, and it is, I want to stress, this is a hypothetical. But let's say the SEC wants to, say, impose a new rule on cryptocurrency. They would now have to run it by the White House. Now, that's a big deal in and of itself. They haven't had to do that. But now, imagine, for example, that the president has a cryptocurrency, as Trump does. So this sets up the White House, first of all, to have a say in some really important areas like finance, but it also could raise legal and ethical questions as its effects play out. But also, I want to add something else. As one legal expert told me, if this executive order were to become the norm, it could create legal or regulatory whiplash, with rules potentially changing with any new administration.
And I mentioned, Danielle, we are watching Trump use this second term in the White House to test and expand presidential powers. How does this fit in?
Well, it goes hand in hand with the fact that he has fired top people at some of these agencies, like the National Labor Relations Board. And like I said earlier, the Supreme Court a long time ago said the president has limited powers in getting rid of those heads. Uh-huh. Well, some of those people have filed suit saying our firings were illegal. So this really sets up yet more clashes between those agencies and the presidency.
And NPR White House correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben, thanks.
Thank you so much.
The Trump administration has said that it would ship the worst of the worst criminal immigrants to the detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. On February 4th, it flew the first group of 10 men there. The administration claimed all 10 were members of the Venezuelan gang Trende de Aragua. But were they, in fact, gang members, or did they just look the part? NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
On February 4th, Peggy Paz was home in Venezuela when she saw the photos the Trump administration had posted of that first group of men headed to Guantanamo. She recognized her 25-year-old son. She posted this anguished video online. He's never done anything wrong, she said. The only bad thing he's ever done was get those tattoos I told him not to get. Court records show her son, Joan Bastidas, has no criminal record in the U.S. other than a 2023 charge for improper entry into the country, a misdemeanor. NPR recently called his mother at her home. She said her son had made the trek to the U.S.-Mexico border to request asylum in late 2023. He was being held at the Federal Detention Center in El Paso, Texas. He often called his mom from there and told her his tattoos were being investigated. He had a lot of tattoos, including stars, the names of his family members, a portrait of his grandfather on his back, a dollar sign on his neck. His mother hated them. She says her son is a good young man, though, who worked in construction. But she also worried his tattoos might land him in trouble. I said to him, before you get a tattoo, do you even find out what it means? And he said, Mom, it's nothing. It's what's in fashion. Now she thinks his tattoos are the reason the government may have chosen him for Guantanamo. In photos the Department of Homeland Security posted to X, the men being sent there are in shackles, about to be loaded onto a plane. Several have their neck tattoos prominently featured.
They've got tattoos. They look scary. You know, they look like, oh my God, thank God.
Susan Phillips teaches at Pitzer College and researches how tattoos are used to identify gang members. She often provides testimony in legal cases.
You know, you put anybody in shackles, you're going to make them look like a criminal, and that becomes how people contextualize their tattoos.
It's unclear how the government ID'd these men as Tren de Aragua gang members. In an email to NPR, the Department of Homeland Security said only that, quote, DHS has a broad intelligence assessment to determine gang affiliation. The families of several of the men have said the government had been scrutinizing their tattoos, and DHS has waffled on its initial claim that they're all members of Tren de Aragua. When the New York Times asked about one of the men, DHS said it could not definitively determine if he was in fact a member of the gang. It then told the paper it had new information that he was, but provided no evidence. Professor Susan Phillips worries these men could have been chosen for Guantanamo because their tattoos make them look like a stereotypical gang member.
They're being very clever about the optics of this. You know, using the way people look to identify, like, who are going to be the poster children for this deportation display.
Peggy Paz says that last year, after her son Joan had already spent several months in the Texas Detention Center telling her his tattoos were being scrutinized, she began to wonder whether he'd ever be allowed into the U.S. to move ahead with his asylum claim. My son, my heart, she said to him, are there others who've been in there as long as you have? And he said, yes, Mom. Eventually, though, his family says he got tired of waiting to be released and agreed to be deported. He was still waiting to be sent home when he was shipped to Guantanamo. The ACLU has sued the Department of Homeland Security to gain access to Bastidas and dozens of other migrants who've been sent to Guantanamo. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. While the Trump administration is aggressively trying to cut government spending, some of the president's most ardent supporters in Congress want to revive federal payments to people sickened by atomic weapons testing decades ago. From member station KNAU, Ryan Heinschus reports from Arizona.
On a windswept desert hillside overlooking Kingman, Arizona, Colin Patillo looks northwest. It's only about 120 miles as the crow flies to the Nevada test site near Las Vegas.
This is essentially what you'd have been looking at in the 1940s or 1950s.
About 100 above-ground nuclear detonations happened at the test site in the 1950s and 60s. Locals could see them from here or catch glimpses of the atomic glow in the pre-dawn hours.
On several occasions, My father and his peers all had stories of watching a bomb blast.
Petillo's family moved to the area in the late 19th century, but in the decades after the tests, his father and his aunt died of cancer. Jean Bishop's family moved here when she was a child. She and all six of her siblings have had cancer too.
We believe it's because of the radiation that floated over the mountains into this area from the nuclear test site in Nevada.
In 1990, Congress authorized compensation payments for those sickened by the atomic bomb testing and manufacturing, including some so-called downwinders who suffered diseases including lung, thyroid, and pancreatic cancer. But despite its proximity to the test site, this area of western Arizona was never covered under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. It left out population centers, including Las Vegas and some tribal lands.
For them to ignore Mojave County as not being touched by this radiation exposure is bizarre, and that's what we're trying to correct.
Last year, the U.S. Senate passed a bill that would have renewed and expanded compensation for downwinders, but House leadership never took up the bill, allowing it to expire in June. Now, Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley is trying to revive it.
It's a moral argument. It's about doing right by the people who love this country and in many cases gave their lives for this country, gave their health for this country.
Hawley's bill would include St. Louis, the site of a major Cold War era uranium processing plant. Generations there have also suffered from rare cancers and other diseases.
It's got big bipartisan support in the Senate. The House needs to act, and we need to get this done. Really, hundreds of thousands of Americans are depending on it.
The cost of the bill, however, could stretch into the tens of billions of dollars. Last week, one of Arizona's most conservative congressmen, Paul Gosar, introduced a less expensive version that would expand benefits only to Mojave County, Arizona, and Clark County, Nevada. Hawley and Gosar's bills have some advocates for radiation compensation optimistic. George Durrani, a Tucson-based attorney who's filed thousands of claims on behalf of downwinders, is watching House Speaker Mike Johnson closely.
I think it's going to come down to whether or not Speaker Johnson has the appetite for introducing a bill on the floor that will add to federal spending.
Speaker Johnson did not respond to requests for comment. Durrani says radiation exposure is an issue that ultimately cuts across ideologies and has impacted nearly every U.S. state.
It is a continuing, unfolding national tragedy. We bombed ourselves. We did this to our own people, and the consequences continue to play out every day.
At a moment of aggressive cost-cutting, a new Radiation Exposure Compensation Act's fate will hinge on support from the very congressional leaders who let the program lapse. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Robberies at a string of NFL and NBA athletes' homes have generated headlines lately. And now the FBI says they're part of an international crime ring. NPR's Bill Chappell has been following the story and joins us now. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Scott.
So tell us about the developments in these cases.
So in a new court case in Florida, seven Chilean men are now facing federal charges. An FBI affidavit alleges the men have been working together to steal jewelry and luxury items from high-end homes. They're charged with conspiring to transport stolen items across state lines from early October into December.
I mean, we're talking about thefts of high-profile athletes' homes. We're talking about international crime rings. This has gotten a lot of attention, but how many cases are we talking about here?
So the FBI says there were six cases where pro athletes had their homes broken into when they were out, often playing at games. The affidavit doesn't say their names, but the information lines up with stars like Kansas City's Patrick Mahomes and Cincinnati's Joe Burrow. It also mentions players from the Memphis Grizzlies and the Milwaukee Bucks. In all, they say the stolen goods and cash adds up to millions of dollars.
Some of the people arrested were already facing other charges. Tell us what we know about them.
Right. So some of that's from the Ohio case with Joe Burrow. There are state and federal charges against four guys there. The FBI says there's a pattern in what they call a South American theft group, where thieves have been breaking into these houses in a coordinated way around the country. Law enforcement agencies said they often came into the U.S. illegally or overstayed their visas, discussing the suspects. And the FBI says they usually rent a car in Florida, use a fake ID, go through temporary phone accounts, and then drive to a home of an athlete and break in. They usually take only high-value items like Rolex watches, jewelry, and Louis Vuitton suitcases.
How has Chile responded to this news?
So it's taking it very seriously, especially because Chile is the only country in South America that has special access for people to visit the U.S. under what's called the Visa Waiver Program. In the past few years, state and federal officials have been saying foreign criminals are abusing the program. And in 2023, those concerns led to the U.S. and Chile signing a new information sharing agreement. I asked the Chilean embassy about this case. And the new case in Florida. And they said, you know, as of last September, Homeland Security in the U.S. has been able to get real-time criminal records of anyone applying for travel for the U.S. under this program. They say more Chileans with criminal backgrounds are being denied travel privileges to the U.S. because of that.
Interesting. That is NPR's Bill Chappell. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
If you, like me, love a good romantic comedy, here's a pattern you may recognize, that one of the love interests is an architect.
So this becomes your office.
Uh-huh.
You come down your new hallway.
Oh, love it.
And from here to there, your kitchen.
Steve Martin is the man with the blueprints there, caught in a love triangle with Meryl Streep. That, of course, is the movie It's Complicated. That is not even the only rom-com where Steve Martin plays an architect. I could also mention Keanu Reeves in The Lake House or Tom Hanks in Sleepless in Seattle, not to mention all the times men pretend to be architects to woo women. Think George Costanza, as played by Jason Alexander in Seinfeld.
Let me be the architect. I can do it. I can do it. Hey, I'm an architect.
So, why the lust for architects? Well, Charlotte Collins tackles this burning question in a piece for Architectural Digest headlined, "Why is the love interest always an architect?" Charlotte Collins, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's get the origin story. Are there foundational movies, TV shows of this archetype?
Oh, 100%. And they're not even necessarily all rom-coms. Some of them are romantic dramas. But we're thinking that the foundation was most likely laid like way back 1969 with Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch.
Huh.
My father's an architect. And as for me, I'd like to become one too and share in that dream.
Come on, Marcia.
No, wait a minute. I'd like to hear this.
Just a very dependable family man, but I think the most classic examples people think of, Tom Hanks in Sleepless in Seattle, Keanu Reeves in The Lake House, Steve Martin in It's Complicated, for sure.
Yeah, and why? Why are architects such great leads? Why are there so many as romantic interests?
I think this is honestly something that carries over to real life. I think if you are hearing out professions for, you know, potential lovers, the idea of somebody being an architect, not only are they dependable, they have the kind of right brain and left brain blend of like, okay, kind of an engineering thought, like somebody who can look at blueprints, but also somebody who's a bit of a dreamer.
Like they feel literally have a plan, which is a good thing when you're
it's a man with a plan, a man with a floor plan, someone you can depend on.
Right. I suppose also they're artists, they're creative, they are also, at least theoretically, employed.
Yes. Yeah, that's a big selling point. Someone who definitely has a job, really hot on the market.
Now, I know you talked to a bunch of people about the appeal of the architect, including the vice president of programming at Hallmark Media, the Hallmark channel, of course, which airs a lot of rom-coms. Her name's Jessica Callahan. What did she tell you?
Oh, she was a joy to speak to. She was talking about a little bit of like the coding of jobs, like where this job is like kind of a hottie coded job. Whereas, you know, in the Hallmark world, the lawyer is the guy who doesn't get the girl. The architect gets the girl. It's a job that you can kind of see as solid. It seems both creative, but also mathematical.
Did you talk to actual architects about this idea?
I did. I spoke to a couple of them, and they both noted that they were familiar with the trope. They're both in relationships and have been for a long time. So apparently two people out there certainly got their happy endings from being architects, but they couldn't remember quite if it was so hot on the dating scene back in the day. But they did note, both of them to me independently, that architects tend to end up with other architects. So it is attractive even to them.
Huh. I can't help but note that the examples we've talked about so far are all men. What about women? Do female leads ever get to be architects?
Yeah, in my sort of research, it did skew a bit male, this trope. And there are a few examples out there of women in this, but they don't get the same sort of swagger that these male characters are written for. I would love to see that happen in a movie. But if you think of an example, there's Michelle Pfeiffer in the rom-com One Fine Day, and she's a mother depicted as like kind of harried, frenzied, running around, trying to take care of it all, trying to have it all, so to speak.
Now, honey, you can't make any noise in the office. I have a really important meeting, okay?
But Amalie Andraus, who is an architect, said that she doesn't feel that the tropes use male. And the most recent example she could think of was Jennifer Garner in Family Switch as like a very hotshot architect and the matriarch of this family.
Charlotte Collins is digital features editor at Architectural Digest. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public.
Thank you.